Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Exiting the Cave Short Reads. This week we're having a look at Chapter 4 of The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius. This chapter is the last chapter before we begin our exploration of the four false pursuits of happiness, those of wealth, honor, power, and pleasure. Philosophy prepares Boethius for this next stage of the discussion by finally pointing him inward to the source of inalienable happiness, his own virtue. We join the pair continuing their dialogue from last week. Let's listen in.
Then I said, "True are thine admonishings, thou nurse of all excellence. Nor can I deny the wonder of my fortune's swift career. Yet it is this which chafes me more cruelly in the recalling. For truly in adverse fortune, the worst sting of misery is to have been happy."
"Well," she said, "if thou art paying the penalty of a mistaken belief, thou canst not rightly impute the fault to circumstances. If it is the felicity which fortune gives that moves thee, mere name though it be, come reckon up with me how rich thou art in the number and weightiness of thy blessings. Then, if, by the blessing of Providence, thou hast still preserved unto thee safe and inviolate that which, howsoever thou mightest reckon thy fortune, thou wouldst have thought thy most precious possession, what right hast thou to talk of ill fortune whilst keeping all fortune's better gifts? Yet Symmachus, thy wife's father, a man whose splendid character does honor to the human race, is safe and unharmed. And while he bewails thy wrongs, this rare nature, in whom wisdom and virtue are so nobly blended, is himself out of danger, a boon thou wouldst have been quick to purchase at the price of life itself. Thy wife yet lives, with her gentle disposition, her peerless modesty and virtue. This is the epitome of all her graces, that she is the true daughter of her sire. She lives, I say, and for thy sake only preserves the breath of life, though she loathes it and pines away in grief and tears for thy absence, wherein, if in naught else, I would allow some marring of thy felicity. What shall I say of thy sons and their consular dignity? How in them, so far as may be in youths of their age, the example of their fathers' and grandfathers' character shines out? Since, then, the chief care of mortal man is to preserve his life, how happy art thou? Couldst thou but recognize thy blessings, who possessest even now what no one doubts to be dearer than life itself? Wherefore, now dry thy tears. Fortune's hate hath not involved all thy dear ones. The stress of the storm that hath assailed thee is not beyond measure intolerable, since there are anchors still holding firm which suffer thee not to lack either consolation in the present or hope for the future. I pray that they still may hold, for while they still remain, however things may go, I shall ride out the storm. Yet thou seest how much is shorn of the splendor of my fortunes." "We are gaining a little ground," said she. "If there is something in thy lot wherewith thou art not yet altogether discontented, but I cannot stomach thy daintiness when thou complainest with such violence of grief and anxiety because thy happiness falls short of completeness. Why, who enjoys such settled felicity as not to have some quarrel with the circumstances of his lot? A troublous matter are the conditions of human bliss. Either they are never realized in full, or never stay permanently. One has abundant riches, but is shamed by his ignoble birth. Another is conspicuous for his nobility, but through the embarrassments of poverty would prefer to be obscure. A third, richly endowed with both, laments the loneliness of an unwedded life. Another, though happily married, is doomed to childlessness and nurses his wealth for a stranger to inherit. Yet another, blessed with children, mournfully bewails the misdeeds of sons or daughters. Wherefore, it is not easy for anyone to be at perfect peace with the circumstances of his lot. There lurks in each several portion something which they who experience it not knowing nothing of, but which makes the sufferer wince. Besides, the more favored a man is by fortune, the more fastidiously sensitive is he. And unless all things answer to his whim, he is overwhelmed by the most trifling misfortunes, because utterly unschooled in adversity. So petty are the trifles which rob the most fortunate of perfect happiness. How many are there, dost thou imagine, who would think themselves nigh heaven if but a small portion from the wreck of thy fortune should fall to them? This very place, which thou callest exile, is to them that dwelleth therein their native land. So true is it that nothing is wretched, but thinking makes it so. And conversely, every lot is happy if born with equanimity. Who is so blessed by fortune as not to wish to change his state, if once he gives rein to a rebellious spirit? With how many bitternesses is the sweetness of human felicity blent? And even if that sweetness seem to him to bring delight in the enjoying, yet he cannot keep it from departing when it will. How manifestly wretched, then, is the bliss of earthly fortune, which lasts not forever with those whose temper is equable, and can give no perfect satisfaction to the anxious-minded. Why, then, ye children of mortality, seek ye from without that happiness whose seat is only within? Error and ignorance bewilder you. I will show thee in brief the hinge on which perfect happiness turns. Is there anything more precious to thee than thyself? Nothing, thou wilt say. If, then, thou art master of thyself, thou wilt possess that which thou wilt never be willing to lose, and which fortune cannot take from thee, and that thou mayst see that happiness cannot possibly consist in these things which are the sport of chance, reflect that, if happiness is the highest good of a creature living in accordance with reason, and if a thing which can in any wise be reft away is not the highest good, since that which cannot be taken away is better than it, it is plain that fortune cannot aspire to bestow happiness by reason of its instability. And besides, a man born along by this transitory felicity must either know or not know its instability. If he knows not, how poor is a happiness which depends on the blindness of ignorance? If he knows it, he needs must fear to lose a happiness whose loss he believes to be possible. Wherefore, a never-ceasing fear suffers him not to be happy. Or does he count the possibility of this loss a trifling matter? Insignificant, then, must be the good whose loss can be borne so equably. And further, I know thee to be one settled in the belief that the souls of men certainly die not with them. And convinced thereof by numerous proofs, it is clear also that the felicity which fortune bestows is brought to an end with the death of the body. Therefore, it cannot be doubted but that, if happiness is conferred in this way, the whole human race sinks into misery when death brings the close of all. But if we know that many have sought the joy of happiness not through death only, but also through pain and suffering, how can life make men happy by its presence when it makes them not wretched by its loss? who found it firm and sure would ever live secure in spite of storm and blast, immovable and fast. Whoso would fain deride the ocean's threatening tide, his dwelling should not seek on sands or mountain peak. Upon the mountain's height, the storm winds wreak their spite. The shifting sands disdain their burden to sustain. Do thou these perils flee, fair though the prospect be, and fix thy resting place on some low rock's sure base. Then, though the tempests roar, seas thunder on the shore, thou in thy stronghold blessed and undisturbed shall rest. Live all thy days serene, and mock the heaven's spleen.
All right, we're back. So strap in, folks. This analysis is going to take you on quite a ride. Philosophy's first order of business is to help Boethius identify his own happiness with the happiness of the family he's created. This is interesting because it suggests a key to both Stoic and Aristotelian virtue, the surrender of self-regard in some degree for the good of another. Her next important move is to get Boethius to stop comparing himself to others. She does this paradoxically by comparing Boethius' complaints about his own life with those whose lots are both much worse and much better, and helping him see that they are all laboring under an illusory standard. The monologue then transitions into a consideration of suffering and its relation to happiness. This may seem incidental or secondary, but it's essential. Aristotle thinks that virtue is not possible without both a capacity for it and an opportunity to develop it. Boethius clearly has the capacity, but he forgets what constitutes the opportunity for developing it. Philosophy reminds him that suffering and adversity function as precisely the external grindstone against which we can polish our own character. Then, to bring the Stoic case to its close, philosophy offers up the line we all recognize as famously from Shakespeare's Hamlet, "Nothing is wretched but thinking makes it so," counseling a rational distance from our own experience in the moment in order to identify the right response to those experiences. Shakespeare, of course, disagrees. Here's the passage from Hamlet where Shakespeare quotes it. It's from Act 2. Note especially the banter in Service to Fortune and the comparison between Denmark and a prison. I think Shakespeare is clearly trying to tell us something about his reading habits. Hamlet. "My excellent good friends, how dost thou, Guildenstern? Ah, Rosencrantz, good lads, how do ye both?" Rosencrantz. "As the indifferent children of the earth." Guildenstern. "Happy in that we are not overhappy. On fortune's cap we are not the very button." Hamlet. "Nor the soles of her shoe?" Rosencrantz. "Neither, my lord." Hamlet. "Then you live about her waist, or in the middle of her favors?" Guildenstern. "Faith, her privates we." Hamlet. "In the secret parts of fortune? Oh, most true. She is a strumpet. What's the news?" Rosencrantz. "None, my lord, but that the world's grown honest." Hamlet. "Then is doomsday near. But your news is not true. Let me question more in particular. What of you, my good friends, deserved at the hands of fortune that she sends you to a prison hither?" Guildenstern. "Prison, my lord?" Hamlet. "Denmark's a prison." Rosencrantz. "Then is the world one?" Hamlet. "A goodly one, in which there are many confines, wards, and dungeons. Denmark being one of the worst. Rosencrantz. We think not so, my lord. Hamlet. Why, then, 'tis none to you. For there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. To me, it is a prison. So, once philosophy is certain she has prepared Boethius for the next stage of his journey, she can finally confront him with her core argument for true happiness, elevating it to the position of master value, and levering Boethius up to the next level of discourse. Seek ye not outside yourself the happiness which is found only within, she says. This is an appeal to eudaimonia, and her argument runs something like this. 1. You say you prize your own life above all other things. 2. Those who genuinely prize their own life above all other things would have crafted a soul that is both priceless and inalienably content. Because why wouldn't you? 3. We know from Aristotle that happiness, the eudaimonia version, is the highest good for creatures living in accordance with reason. 4. We know that you seek that which is the highest good. 5. We know that fortune's gifts are, in fact, alienable, from our prior discussions. 6. Therefore, that which you seek cannot be that which fortune could offer you, and would be something that would be inseparable from your soul. 7. Thus, this something must be a moral and spiritual good, and one found only in the soul, in other words, eudaimonia. Resting her case, philosophy argues finally that because the soul does not die with the body, but the felicities of fortune do, and because death means union with God, this is implicit, then true happiness could not be found on earth. This is an important telegraphing moment. Philosophy is telling us that while Boethius's transition to the realm of virtue is essential, his journey is far from complete. At some point in the future, we'll be forced to part company with Aristotle and be led the rest of the way by Plotinus and Plato. But we'll all have to stay tuned for that. Before I conclude today's episode, I want to circle back for a moment on the passage from Hamlet and to make a few additional closing remarks. It seems to me that in the context of the story of Boethius, this segment from Hamlet takes on whole new layers of textured meaning that it lacked at first glance. With Boethius lurking in the background, we get a palpable sense of foreboding of what is to come for Hamlet. In this brief banter-like exchange with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, we're treated to the entirety of Boethius' Stoic and Aristotelian view of Hamlet's situation. We understand the futility of Hamlet fighting against his fate, and we can lament his failure to leave a legacy like the one Boethius left. What's more, a single reference like this is a cultural compression tool of immense value. Shakespeare including this one phrase opened up his viewers to the entire history of Western thought and situated Hamlet within the Roman Christian tradition. But to appreciate the power of this kind of writing, you have to already be vaguely familiar with who Boethius was, what he wrote, and why he wrote it. Growing up in the Midwest in the 70s and 80s, the chances of that happening were very low for me. Public school teachers approached their work with a sneering cynicism that cowed even the most enthusiastic of learners. The intellectual and emotional repression of the public school system hid Boethius, Aristotle, and Plato from me and rendered authors like Shakespeare utterly unreadable, ripped unceremoniously out of the culture within which he is found and exsanguinated of all the living meaning he could possibly have beyond the utterly superficial. By the time I graduated high school, you would have needed to be an emotional Hercules to have maintained any strong commitment to anything good or true or beautiful in the Western canon. It took me 30 years of wallowing and searching to find it all again. This is as dangerous as it is tragic, I think. I'm a man of ordinary intelligence, but admittedly extraordinary constitution. That constitution somehow afforded me the capacity to survive the relentless council of grayed-out despair peddled by the institution that was tasked with making a good citizen out of me. But how many of my peers managed to survive that? Who, following behind me in the decades since, understands what they are being robbed of? What sort of civilization will they erect, being so mangled by ignorance, cynicism, and loathing for their own cultural tradition? Our civilization is sick. And though the school systems are not necessarily the ultimate cause, they are certainly significant vectors of disease transmission. I'm not entirely sure what the solution to this problem is, but I wonder if someone like me could even suggest one, given that the biggest minds of our age have pondered it all their lives and not seem to come up with a clear answer themselves. I will end this little rant with an audio clip from a discussion between Jordan Peterson and Roger Scruton on the nature of the problem as it presents itself in institutions of higher education. It's apropos, I think, because it reinforces my lament for a solution and offers a convenient appeal to authority in support of my own concern about the culture. And with that, I'll see you next week.
I think, as an academic, we talked already about that place where the meaning and the fact are conjoined, and that's the proper place to lecture from, because people who lecture constantly make the presumption that they're there to deliver a set of facts, but there's an infinite set of facts, and so at the very least you have to select the facts, and there's a mechanism that selects the facts. And what you want to do as an academic is tell your students through direct discourse and also through action about something that you've encountered that you've fallen in love with. And to communicate the love that you have for that, the love for literature, and not to say, well, you should read this book, but to say, well, here's this book, and here's what it can open up for you, and this is how it does it, and this is what you'll gain from it. It's an inestimable gain, and there's some struggle in it, but there's something in it that's of unbelievable utility, and you have to believe that in order to communicate it. And then that opens one of those doors, you know, and maybe some students will step through that and think, well, maybe that sounds like something I need. I'm in this dire situation and I need something. I need a life raft. I need something to buoy me upward. And it's going to take some effort, obviously, because nothing worthwhile comes without effort to communicate that commitment you have to these phenomena that we already talked about, to beauty and to truth and to literature and to the classics in the humanities. It isn't enough to say what they are and to transmit them. It's to manifest yourself as a living part of that tradition and to show yourself thereby as a model for living out as much as you can what that tradition represents, and to show that that's so much better than like a short-term pleasure-seeking nihilism, that they're not even in the same conceptual universe. And people are far more open to that. They know already. People know, especially when they're hurt. They know that happiness is fleeting and that suffering requires a sustaining meaning. Everyone who's lived knows that. And so to say, well, here's some balm for the suffering, and it's profound and deep, and here's what it's meant to me, and here's how you can incorporate it into your life. It's like people are absolutely starving for that. Or dying of thirst for that.
I mean, this connects with what you earlier said about the curriculum, that the old way of teaching the humanities was in that manner, as objects of love. This is what I have loved, what previous generations have loved too, and handed on to me. Here, try it out, and you will love it too. Whereas the postmodern curriculum is a curriculum of hatred. It's directed against our cultural inheritance. One after another, the works are paraded before us, stripped naked and thrashed, you know, by revealing whatever ideology or power structure is being concealed within them. And that, of course, is not why they were written, and it's not how they should be understood.
It's not why they survived and remembered either. But it's like, this is the best that the best of us could produce, yeah. And it's nothing. Yes. Well, why should you bother doing anything?
Well, exactly.
Then?
And it means that students who go through that curriculum come out with a sense of the hopelessness of everything. And
thus are successfully educated by postmodernist standards.
Yes. Yeah, I suppose that's right.